This is Gigs Unleashed, episode 25. Hello, welcome to Gigs Unleashed, episode 25. I'm Mark.
And I'm Jasmine.
Each week we cover the news of the week and we pick a couple of things to review that caught our fancy in TV, comics, movies and games. This week's reviews are Sea of Sorrows issue 1 from IDW Publishing and the Supernatural series finale on the CW.
And spoiler warning, this is a review show. So if you have not had a chance to sum up your 15 years of Supernatural viewing or read Sea of Sorrows, you might want to pause this and come back after you've watched or read. And then at the very end of the episode, we'll give you a couple of recommendations of our own.
Whoop, whoop. 25 episodes, Jasmine.
I know. That's kind of like a little mini milestone for us, right?
Oh, I know. Yeah. I can't believe we started in June. I was like, actually, I only realized that last week when I was like, hold on a minute. We talked about San Diego Comic Con. I was like, what? That was in July.
Yeah.
And it is almost December. Christmas is coming.
25 episodes. That's 25 weeks in a row.
I know, that's actually the most consistent thing I think I've ever done besides
going to work. Yeah, me too, besides go to work.
I mean, my boss should be grateful that I show up 25 days running. This week was a struggle. So tired and all week. But yeah, I think it's getting to that point in the year where everyone's like looking for Christmas.
It's the fatigue.
Yeah, although you've got Thanksgiving, so you have some time off coming up.
Yeah, so we have next Thursday and Friday off.
Oh, how amazing. So
yeah,
that's we don't have any bank holidays from August onwards. August to Christmas, we have no bank holidays.
Really?
So, no, nothing. So
yeah, but your kids get a break, right? Because you guys have like some kind of fall break.
Oh yeah, half term. They get in October they get a week off.
Yeah, but you don't get anything, huh?
Oh no, it just makes my life harder for a week. So that's like double.
Him
that's
kids?
Like that's like having two jobs for a whole week. So yeah. Like they get to stay at home and I get to work from home at the moment. So,
yeah. You know, I used to say like, oh, we don't get a fall break here. But for the most part, I think at least grade school kids or kids that are 18 and under, usually they get an entire week off for Thanksgiving. So we kind of do have some kind of fall break. Now, it's not the same in college. In college, we really only got Thursday and Friday off. But I think young kids like 18 and under, they do get the whole week off, so they have some semblance of a fall break.
To be fair, actually, for half term, one of my kids did go to stay at my mom and dad's for a couple of days, but my other one wanted to stay home. I want to stay with daddy, she kept saying. And it was quite sweet. But yeah, and actually she was really well behaved. I was actually quite taken aback by the fact that she allowed me to work and didn't bother me. It was quite nice. Yeah.
Make you dress up as a princess and have tea time and any of that?
No. There was at one point, she actually was really good. She kind of, if she did sit in the same room as me, she would put headphones on and have her tablet on or whatever. But there was a couple of times where she did want my attention, and I did give it to her because obviously she was fairly good. But there was one point, I remember it was second or third day on her own with me, and randomly around 2 or 3 o'clock, she said to me, can I play Monopoly with you? And I went, all right, go on then. So I sat down and played 20 minutes of Monopoly, like the middle of the day. But I don't ever take a lunch break, like, because I'm working from home. I know that you can get pulled here and there. So, so for instance, when I got asked to play 20 minutes of Monopoly, I was like, okay, this is my lunch break now. Obviously good for you having the break, and yeah, 25 episodes is where this conversation started.
Yeah, congratulations to us.
We've done 26 episodes, 27. This will be 27th episode though,
including
the book club. So two book club episodes. We're a third one on the way, and 25 weekly episodes of this. So
yeah.
And
how's that for consistency?
I know. And in one, and actually the San Diego Comic Con one, we did it 2 episodes in 1 week.
Oh my gosh. That was hard. I don't want to do that again.
Well, you say that, we'll be back next year. So
I might have to take some time off next year. Cause that was a struggle to get through that and like a full work day.
Oh yeah, I know. I watched, and actually, I think it's harder because we watched a lot of the video panels, which we wouldn't be able to watch without actually going there.
Yeah, so we actually had more content to talk about.
Yeah. Speaking of things to talk about, Wonder Woman 1984. I was quite shocked by this. I'll be honest, I was waiting.
Everyone is shocked by this.
Well, what I was expecting was news that Wonder Woman 1984 would be pushed back.
Yeah.
So I think they probably thought, no, we can't keep kicking it down the can. We've kicked it down the can all year.
Well, that's what Patty Jenkins said, because she said something on Twitter about it, and she was like, we love this movie. We want this movie to get into the hands of the fans.
Yeah.
Plus, we kind of want to spread some holiday cheer.
Yeah.
I don't know how this movie is going to make blockbuster movie money on HBO Max.
So, yeah, to clarify then, there will be a simultaneous launch of Wonder Woman 1984 in theaters on December 25th in America. I presume it will probably come out the 26th over here because they won't be open on Christmas Day.
Well, they have an international, the international release date is earlier, so it's the 16th outside of the US.
Okay, so we'll get it a little bit earlier. Yeah. And then, however, HBO Max will in America launch it on the 25th of December, and it will then be available for 31 days on HBO Max for free. Well, not for free, included in the package, which I thought was actually really cool.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So it will not be paid extra like Mulan or any of the other pay-per-view stuff which has come out this year, which would have been in theaters. And then actually day 32 to 60 will be at theaters only in America again. And then beyond 60 days, it's sort of pay for it. You have to pay for it. So
it goes to video on demand after that. It'll still be in theaters too, but it also hits video on demand.
I can't really see the point in that at that point. Like, if you've not watched it in the first 31 days, you're probably unlikely to go and pay for it, I would say.
Yeah, well, but also the question with the streaming is, supposedly HBO Max doesn't have 4K, so you're watching it in just, I say regular, like regular HD. I don't know. I don't know if they're just banking on, is this going to be the thing that has, like, people, are they going to trust people to actually say, no, this is a blockbuster movie, I'm going to go to the movie theater to watch it? Because I don't know if that's going to work.
I want to go and see it at the cinema.
I do too, but I'm not going on December 25th or not anytime soon.
You go the day after, 26th. I wouldn't worry. There'd be hardly anyone there. Like, what you could do is pay for the seats either side.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we have HBO, so I mean, I'm going to see it. Yeah, but is that really the way that I want to see it? No. So the first movie made $822 million. So it's going to be very interesting to see what kind of numbers the sequel pulls in.
I'll go. I'm not over the moon about the idea of wearing a mask for a 2-hour movie. I might have to suck it up though. Maybe I'll put a hole in the mask so I can have the straw.
That's cheating.
I don't know. But they might. Maybe they'll make cinema masks.
Rebreathers or something.
Who knows? I meant more like with the ability to. Do you know what? Maybe you need to wear a motorbike helmet, into the cinema, something big, something that you can just have food in. That would be perfect if they could make cinema masks. So there's like a big dish around your head.
Like a feeding trough, basically, like what horses have.
Just pour
the popcorn in the bag and then munch on it.
Maybe you just press a button or something, and then it around each one, and it flicks some popcorn in your mouth or something. I don't know.
You should work on patenting that.
This is it. And if anyone steals this idea, we have recorded this podcast. There's got to be a way forward to sit in the cinema without having to wear a piece of cloth over your face for 2 hours. But anyway. I will be down for it. I'd love to go and see this.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to see it in theaters. I probably won't do it that soon. I might, maybe that could be something I do in January. But also, Jason Kilar, the CEO of WarnerMedia, released an actual statement. It's a very lengthy statement. You can probably find it on Deadline or Variety if you want to read the statement in full. But he does go into detail about what decisions went into this, why they chose to do it, those kinds of things. But lucky for a lot of people, now that they've got something, if you're not going to be watching basketball, NBA basketball, then now you have something else that you can watch on Christmas Day with your family.
Actually, yeah, that's quite a nice shout, actually, to Christmas Day, be able to watch Wonder Woman 1984, mm-hmm. like the Christmas movie. We don't have HBO over here, so I don't know how that'll work over here, but 16th of December, I will go watch it.
Well, then you can tell me all about it. We could talk about it on the podcast after December 25th.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to go on the 16th of December, but I will go maybe at some point. I have the week off before Christmas, so maybe I'll go that week.
Well, I kind of wonder, like, HBO is used to heavy loads when it comes to streaming because of, I imagine a lot of people stream Game of Thrones the same way that they watch it live. So, but I don't know that they have the ability to handle that kind of stream. Like, I
the entire country.
Yeah, exactly. The country that's starved for content, especially big superhero content. So, that's going to be a super interesting experiment. I'm very interested to follow that and see how that plays out on HBO, if HBO can handle it technically, and what the monetary numbers end up looking like.
Maybe when you watch Wonder Woman, you just might have to get used to like a swirling circle in the middle of the screen for 2 hours.
Yeah, so a two-hour movie lasts 5.5 hours.
Yeah. Or Error. Like,
yeah. Oh, gosh.
Cannot play or whatever. So anyway, there you go. Simultaneous launch of Wonder Woman 1984, HBO Max in America and in cinemas. And let's see what happens.
Yeah.
So I can't imagine the cinemas are still pleased about a simultaneous launch.
No, I doubt it. But also, like, a lot of them are not open right now. Yeah, so are they going to bite the bullet and open and do Christmas launches for one movie? I mean, in theory, you got a 30 screen theater. You could show Wonder Woman on 30 screens since there's not much else going on. So. Mm.
They could also do both of them, like double.
Yeah, I mean, because one of the concerns was, well, the number of screens that are going to be available during the pandemic is already going to be much lower than usual. So how do they make up for A, the reduced number of screens, but like B, the fact that people can also stream it without any additional cost if they're already paying for the service? But that could be the answer. Like, if there's no new content, you probably keep one or two movies that are geared towards much younger kids. But if you've got a 30 screen theater, you could literally show Wonder Woman on 25 screens, and that could make up for, you know, the lack of access, theatrical access. So.
And income for the last however many months.
Yeah, because most people, a lot of theaters are moving away from the 35mm format anyway. So if they're playing it on a digital projector, then there's no reason. Plus, you could open yourself up to better showtimes. So, like, there could be, like, a showing of Wonder Woman starting every 10 minutes. Like, all day, you know? So, hey, we'll see. That's going to be an interesting thing to keep up with. So I'm very eager to see how that plays out.
So moving on to Wonder Girl, new Wonder Girl TV show at CW, basically. So there's a potential Arrowverse show from Greg Berlanti. So it'll focus on Yara Flor, which is a character created by Joelle Jones. Also is going to have she's going to be the star of a new sort of two issue DC Future State, which we talked about a couple of episodes ago, in January and February, and she's going to be Wonder Woman in those two Future State issues. But yeah, so that's kind of it, really. Just there's going to be a pilot and that's about it. Hopefully we'll turn into a TV series, but yeah.
Yeah, it'll be the first Latin American superhero as well. So that'll be, or like on TV. So that'll be pretty cool. I'm sorry, Latin American woman, because technically Ghost Rider was Latin American as well. So, or Latino. I was gonna say
I'm getting more frustrated with all this news about shows, and can they not just tell us about Green Arrow and the Canaries?
Yeah. No, they want to tell you about new stuff. It sounds like she's got a pretty interesting story, and from the art that they've released so far about Yara, she's gorgeous. Like, first of all, I'm biased. I love Joelle Jones's style. So the new Wonder Girl, she looks really cool, and I'm really interested to see what her powers are, what kind of story she has. So she's basically the daughter of an Amazonian and a Brazilian river god. And it kind of sounds like the CW is going to be doing like a coming of age story with Wonder Girl. So, we'll see.
I don't think this is going to be connected to the Titans Wonder Girl. I think this is a brand new Wonder Girl.
Yeah.
Connected more with the Flash. And
yes, I think it's definitely going to be Arrowverse connection versus anything else.
Yeah. I imagine this is probably to fill the hole that Supergirl is going to leave.
Yeah.
And also, another vacancy has arrived.
Yeah.
I was shocked by this.
Me too.
Black Lightning is going to end at the end of season 4. Which follows the news that we said last week about Painkiller spin-off. No doubt the two things are connected. However, they decided to probably release that news a week apart. So last week we told you that Painkiller is getting a spin-off. And the CW have confirmed that season 4 of Black Lightning will be also the final season of Black Lightning. So I'm quite disappointed, especially with the fact that as of season 3, they tied Black Lightning into the Arrowverse.
Yeah.
Kind of referenced it a little bit at the end of the Black Lightning, and at the end of Crisis on Infinite Earths, made Black Lightning a vital part of, I guess, the sort of the Flash's version of Justice League. And then you've only given him one season left, and that's it. So,
yeah, that's a real bummer.
So,
So the showrunner for Black Lightning is also going to be the executive producer and showrunner for the Painkiller spinoff.
Mm.
And so that's Salim Akil. And he said that he was incredibly proud of the work that they've been able to do and the moments that they've been able to create in bringing DC's first African-American family of superheroes to life for the culture. And while season 4 may be the end of one journey, he's extremely excited to usher in a new chapter and a continued collaboration with the CW as they tell the story of Painkiller. My one beef with this is everybody is so excited about, oh, diversity and inclusion, now is the time, and oh, you know, Batwoman is going to be a Black woman now, and we've got our first Latin American, or not Latin American, but Latina superhero coming up, starring in her own series. But it's like, you can't have too much diversity at one time. So we got to get rid of Supergirl, which is led by a series led by a woman. Got to get rid of that. And we're going to bring in Superman and Lois instead. They got to get rid of Black Lightning. But we have another Black series. So it's cool because we got Painkiller. And it's just like, why can't we just have all of these things at the same time? Why does it have to be one or the other?
It doesn't really interest me having a Painkiller show. I'll be honest. I hope that they bring in like Lightning, played by China, and
China McClane. Yeah,
like, I like China. She's really good. I mm-hmm. can remember seeing her because my kids, obviously, as I keep saying, I have kids. Used to watch her in Ant Farm on the Disney Channel, and also in the Disney movies where they're all fantasy characters, the children of
what is that called? I can't remember, but yes, I know what you're talking about, where they're like children of villains, like, and children of
villains. They're children of villains, and she's really cool. I've seen that as well. I've watched it with them, and obviously playing Lightning, which is an extremely different character, like, and mm-hmm. when we watch it, we're shocked that like Disney is like allowing her to be like profanity and talking about sex and drugs and all that.
I really wanted her to do like a musical episode because I actually love her singing voice. So like that's what I want with Black Lightning. Like I want them to have a musical episode like the Flash did.
Oh, the fashion Supergirl. They did the musicals crossover episode.
Yeah, since they both were on Glee. Like, on Glee, I don't know. I'm a sucker for that kind. Plus, Jesse L. Martin. What's not to love about Jesse L. Martin? So
I can't imagine Black Lightning having a music episode. It's so serious. Like, Black Lightning it very rarely ever has humor. But it does occasionally have humor, but it's very rare. So it'd be a real shock to suddenly have them singing and dancing and but it'd be cool though. I'm assuming that Lightning will be in Painkiller, because it's obviously, like you said, it's not the complete end of the journey. I think what they could have done is, rather than Painkiller, what would have been cool would be so Black Lightning and the Outsiders. So like more of a team. Mm-hmm. So because it kind of feels like season three was venturing into team like world. Mm-hmm. And you know, Black Lightning has led the Outsiders a couple of times in the comics. I know there's been a recent book which got cancelled, Black Lightning and the Outsiders, where Batman was kind of overseeing the team. Mm-hmm. But Black Lightning was like the team leader on the streets, and then he had a mixture of characters in there. And they've had previous runs of Outsiders, and Thunder and Lightning and stuff like that have been in the Outsiders. And I think it was there was a run, it was about 15, 20 years ago, where Nightwing was the team leader. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know. I would ditch this Painkiller thing, have an Outsiders TV series, have Painkiller, Lightning, Thunder, all the rest of it. Even if you just have Black Lightning, maybe just showing up here and there and just mm-hmm. being more of a mentoring role. That would be, I'd rather have that. I would be much more down with that. But maybe I'll watch Painkiller and I'll like it. But yeah.
I don't know. Like, my favorite thing about Black Lightning was just the family dynamic. Because it seems like every superhero always has to come from some kind of horrible, awful backstory with dead parents, dead sibling. You know, like, it's just so dreary and drab. And you hardly ever get to see, like, happy superhero families. I mean, granted, like, Jefferson Pierce is him and his wife are divorced, but like, they still have this incredible connection, the four of them. So that was always really nice to see. Like, and I think the only other show that was close to that was The Flash, the way that sort of the West family had adopted, so to speak, Barry.
All right, yeah.
So I'm gonna miss that dynamic, really, because there aren't, none of the other shows have that.
Well, they'll have it with Lois and Clark.
Well, we'll see. Superman and Lois.
Superman and Lois with their two boys, whatever that is. But anyway, sad. But yeah. I don't know. Sad, but let's see what happens. Hopefully, I don't know. Hopefully, they'll bring a fair chunk of the cast across to Painkiller.
Yeah, or at least cameos or something. So two shows out at the CW. Two shows coming in. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how it goes. So 2021 is going to wrap up Supergirl and Black Lightning, apparently, and then more than likely 2022 is when we're going to get Painkiller and the Wonder Girl series. So all right, so our first review this week is a comic, new comic called Sea of Sorrows. It's the first issue from IDW Publishing. It's created and written by Rich Doick. The art is by Alex Cormack, and this is touted as a maritime horror comic. Mm-hmm. And it has a very sort of old-timey feel to me. It's set in 1926. The book opens with them on the open sea. There's someone diving, they're basically scavenging, they're looking for a boat that's filled with gold, and you find that information out later. But so it opens up, it starts out by setting up some very interesting cast of characters, who all of these people have some kind of background conflict that you don't know about as the reader, but it does create a really, really cool bit of tension right from the beginning. The premise is pretty basic. It's a basic formulaic, like, adventure kind of story where somebody comes and sits down at a table and says, hey guys, guess what? So-and-so and such told me about this treasure and we got to go get it. And it's like, well, we got to put together a crew. And then of course, hijinks ensue. Now this is, there's not much humor here. There are a couple of throwaway lines that kind of made me giggle, but it's definitely not like a funny story. It's not quite a ghost story, but it's nothing like Jaws or like Cujo. Like it's not a rogue animal story either, but there are some creatures that seem to have motives of their own. So there's definitely a mystery behind what's going on with these creatures. It's not very long. The description says it's 32 pages, but that's not accurate because the last few pages of the book is a preview of another comic from the same author. So this one, it's fairly short. But in that short amount of time, the dialogue is so snappy and witty, and it drives the story at a pretty good pace. But the artwork is what really shines the most to me in this book. It's that kind of imperfect art that's sometimes ugly, but it's perfectly suited for the situation and for the genre that they're trying to come across with this horror comic. And the way that everybody is drawn so gritty, and like the boat is dirty and grimy, and it's just, it's almost exactly what you imagine a 1926 scavenging vessel in the middle of the North Atlantic would look like. Like everything is sort of hodgepodge. The crew is hodgepodge. You've got factions within the crew that don't like each other. There's some kind of nefarious plot that's very apparent. But you have no idea what it is as the reader. It's just little conversations that some of the people are having with each other that kind of clue you into somebody is going to turn on somebody, or somebody has some information that they're going to give to the wrong person. So it's definitely setting up a very interesting story. And there's going to be two conflicts, I imagine, as the book continues. You're going to have the conflict with whatever that creature is that they come across, and you're going to have the conflict within the actual humans that are aboard this vessel. But the combination of the snappy dialogue and this art is really kind of what makes this book a standout. Now, when I went to the comic shop to pick this book up, it was already sold out. So I missed my chance to pick up a hard copy. And I really kind of wish that I had, because some of the full page spreads in this, especially the underwater sequences in this book, they're so gorgeous, which is surprising because most of the page is black because they're so deep underwater that there's just no light penetrating whatsoever. But to be able to draw such vivid and wonderful underwater scenes without it seeming dark was really kind of cool. And when it gets to the underwater part, that's when I think the book shines the most, when it's following the character's name is Nick. He's the diver. Because the tension underwater when he comes across the submarine, he finds there's a great white shark. There's all kinds of like obstacles that he gets through before he gets to this submarine that they've been looking for. But there's something off about Nick, and you can kind of tell that there's something off about him just because he's so quiet for such a rowdy bunch of people. So the tension really kind of just leaps off the pages once you get to following him around underwater. And that's kind of at the point where I want to call it like the point of no return, where like once you get to the submarine reveal that they did find it, they're in the right place, they found what they're looking for, there is gold aboard the submarine, then it's kind of like, oh, okay, great, cool. I'm in this story for the long haul. So now that's when they kind of introduce, I keep calling it a creature. It looks like a mermaid, but like a very scary kind of mermaid. And she doesn't harm Nick that we know of, but when he finally gets pulled back up to the surface, he's talking to another guy on the boat, Turns out that guy on the boat was on that submarine and is the reason that the submarine sank. So this, I feel like this story is going to take the whole like siren song to a whole new level, because he was sort of the comms advisor, I'm guessing, on this German submarine. And he was listening to the sonar before, just before he like went crazy and took the wrench and decided to start banging and breaking pipes aboard the submarine. So what did he hear? Was it some kind of mind control, or is it just, did he hear a voice that made him commanded him to do this to the vessel? I don't know. There's so much that I want to know about this story. But the thing was, I was so engrossed in reading it that I completely lost track of what page I was on. And by the time it gets to the end of this German guy explaining what happened on the submarine and how some of them made it and some of them didn't, it ends. And it ends with a full page spread of all of these terrified Navy men staring at a floating mermaid. And it's just kind of like, the hell's going on with this book? it hasn't gotten to like the horror part of it yet. It's very eerie. There, like I said, there's a lot of tension, but I, for the first time in a long time of any of the comics that we've read and reviewed, I am actually considering picking this up next month, because I really want to know what the deal is with this mermaid and how she convinced this guy to sink an entire special secret German submarine. And why was that submarine carrying so much gold on it? Like, I just have so many questions. And I don't know, I haven't enjoyed a book this much, a single issue book this much, since we started with Firepower.
Yes. this book really, do you know what, it actually made me remember a miniseries by Scott Snyder called The Wake, which is also illustrated by Sean Murphy, and very similar style, but has really horrible looking mermaids in, like in this book. But the mermaids in that book were almost like zombie looking. Wake is kind of told 200 years apart. There's like a thing, you know, and then they show the aftermath 200 years later, which is sort of a water world-esque thing, and the artwork is very, well, I wouldn't say overly similar, but it takes darker tones, but this artwork is extremely unique. I actually have to say, like, I, you know, when you said about the underwater scenes being completely black, that's actually some of my favorite pages actually throughout this book, is like with where Nick's underwater. Actually, it's the bit where he's sort of walking around looking at the cargo, and, you know, he says like bingo and things like that, and he sort of finds it, and it's quite poor lit, and you can see the trunks the boxes, because he shines his torch or something on the boxes. And then he turns around and sees this mermaid, but then she's gone. But what I love about the mermaid is her eyes. Like, there's just like, it's almost like there's just nothing there. But clearly there is something there, because obviously, you know, the stories that get told about her later, and clearly the fact that she moves around, she's not a fish, it's obviously some sort of intelligence there. But obviously it's the horror aspect, so, and the intrigue and the mystery, so who is she, etc. But this book, honestly, would never be as good as it is without the artwork.
Oh yeah, 100%.
Though, like you, though, I found this book quite thin for a first issue. I would have been up for either double sized or more pages or something. Because for me it was quite slow in the beginning, but then this is a problem with a lot of first somethings, first episodes, first issues. You're trying to introduce a new world, a load of new characters, and then you're trying to get all of that in. But then you then need to then do the usual and set up the cliffhanger to get people to come back next issue or episode or whatever it is. And that's actually something I'll come back to later in this podcast, actually. But the last three or four pages is when, like, everything, you know, like, sort of in my mind goes down. Like you said, Nick is on the side of the boat, having a cigarette, and then someone says, you know, starts telling the story, and I love how suddenly it goes into flashback mode and starts showing like the war.
Yeah.
Which
suddenly the book got really bloody at that point.
Oh yeah, like yeah. So it really does. The coloring in this is actually phenomenal. Shows how well yeah. how dark coloring can be used. Mm-hmm. Do you know, colorists do not get enough praise in books. You always talk about the writer, you talk about the illustrator, you know, the penciler, mm-hmm. but very rarely does anyone talk about who did the colors. Mm-hmm. And the coloring in this book is actually just phenomenal. Yeah. And without the colorist, this book would not be what it is. So with this book, the artist and the colorist are the same person.
Yeah.
So Alex Cormack has done both.
Yeah.
However, in many books that is not the case.
But I think honestly, this like it's exactly what you said. This book would not be the same without the art. Period.
Yeah.
It's so good.
That scene where they're flashing back to the war and you're just seeing guns getting yep. shoved into people's necks and you know just. It literally is just like a page of red.
Mm-hmm. It's a double page spread of red. That's it. It's red. You can see bullets going through bodies. There's bowels falling out of soldiers. There's all kinds of blood and gore. I mean, it's insane. But there's so much detailing. And again, the background on that page or those couple of pages, it's all black. And then you have these silhouetted soldiers against nothing but this giant spray of red. It's really, really visually stunning to get through this book.
And the last two pages as well, again, art-wise, I love that just before the final page, when the submarine comes into the sort of out of the sea
mm-hmm.
and is like halfway up in the air
yeah.
and all the splashing of waves, it's actually like the polar opposite to the bottom half of the page, because the bottom half of the page is still very dark. Mm-hmm. And then the top half of the page that's coming out of the water is very white and kind of bright because all that water is coming out. And then that final page with the mermaid full on page to herself, just what naked and screaming and those cold dead eyes and everything. Yeah. I'm like, and then it ends and I'm like, oh,
yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So I'm sort of on the fence a little bit whether or not I'd pick up a second issue or wait for a graphic novel, because I could see me reading the second issue and be like, oh, but then that is the thing with reading single issues.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that is the forever ongoing problem about reading a single issue monthly is, oh, you know, next month, next night. I think this would read really well collected. Only five issues, I think it is.
It's sort of like a one shot mini, right?
It's just a mini series. Well,
yeah.
I mean,
well, not one shot, but mini.
No, but I mean, if it's popular enough, I'm sure there'll be further minis. But it is just billed as a mini series, 5-6 issues. I can't remember, but yeah.
Well, I'm definitely gonna have to put in my order early at the comic shop because, like I said, they sold out by the time I got there.
You might be able to get the first issue online somewhere, like eBay or something. But
yeah,
I mean. So the story wise, I actually did enjoy it. There was, I probably would say the first 75% was really setting the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Like you say, the mystery, the gold, the submarine, a bit of introduction about characters. Then the last sort of 25% was really like suddenly got, like you say, quite gory and telling you about what happened.
I
would happily read more of this. I really enjoyed this. I rarely pick up an IDW book. It's probably a comic company I don't tend to read as much of their content. Mm-hmm. It's obviously a mainly license driven comic company, you know, Turtles and stuff like that, so I don't often look IDW's away. So if you're the same, I'd recommend picking this up.
Yeah, Sea of Sorrows, like I said, this is probably one of the best books I've read since Firepower from Marvel. So,
and Adventure Man.
Oh, Adventure. Okay, I'm sorry. I forgot about Adventure. Adventure Man is fantastic. That was a fantastic book.
Yeah, there's been a lot of good indie books this year. Adventure Man and Firepower, probably two standouts.
Yeah.
I'll be interested to read more of this. But we rated this first issue 3.5 out of 5.
Mainly we docked it because it was so short.
Yeah.
So if the next issue doesn't have like 8 preview pages of another book, then it could be a little bit better, because that's 8 more pages you could use to tell a deeper story. Mm. So we'll see. But yeah, we definitely recommend Sea of Sorrow.
Now, 15 years.
Carry on my wayward son. There'll be peace when you are done. Lay your weary head to rest. Don't you cry no more.
You're saving people, hunting things, family business.
15 years. Jasmine, I've done every episode for the last 15 years, so we're going to review the Supernatural series finale. It would be difficult for us whilst reviewing this to not address 15 years of content.
Yeah.
Clearly, this isn't a 15-year review. I have.
We
not,
don't have the time.
Yeah. I mean, I will be here in about 8 hours if you want to review 15 seasons. Just so everyone knows, Jasmine hasn't watched the last few seasons. I
did. I will be the first to admit, I loved Supernatural. Loved it. I loved it so much. I went to a Supernatural convention back when they were still on season 7. But I just reached my breaking point in season 8 when they started bringing back characters only to kill them off. And most of the characters that they were bringing back were women, which really pissed me off. Like, why bring her back if you're just going to kill her? Sarah. Bringing Sarah back from season 1, the one girl that I really, really wanted Sam to end up with, but whatever, I'm not bitter. And then also, that was a season 8, they killed Kevin, who was the prophet. So I was just, and they had also killed, I believe they killed Felicia Day too, her character, they killed Charlie off. And I was just like,
They brought her back. but anyway.
I had gotten fed up with it, so I stopped watching at season 8, but I couldn't miss the series finale, so I did watch the series finale.
It was a show, to be honest, in the last 15 years has been extremely trigger happy with killing people off, and then like it's like about 2 weeks later they're like, crap, done it again. Like they were kind of, they did over the last 15 years always go for that moment of, yeah, let's kill someone off, that'll be shocking. But it did ruin it, shocks with killing characters off, because you're just gonna bring them back. Yeah, like even in the last season, they had a thing, I think, where they, they killed off Castiel, but they kind of bring him back, but you don't see him come back, because in the final episode they mentioned that he's back, but you don't see him. So again, it was like, well, you killed him off 2 episodes before, and he had a real heart to heart with Dean, telling Dean how much he loves him just before he got killed off, like by the Empty. So anyway. Throughout season 15, season 15 has been obviously a season which had to address, well, we tried to wrap up as much as it could as it went along the way. Well, whilst at the end of season 14, it set up the villain of season 15. So that's actually something that has run throughout the last 15 years of this show, has been almost rinse repeat formula driven show. Now, don't get me wrong, like, there's really great moments throughout the show, but it has been villain of the season set up normally quite early on within the first 2 or 3 episodes of the season, and you kind of had the groundwork laid for them at the end of the previous season. So season 1 will end, and you know, and they'll kind of leave something hanging for next year's villain, or or cliffhanger-ish or whatever, and it's kind of been the same throughout the last 15 years. And then each season starts with, like, sort of not between episodes 1 to 2 to 3, something like that, of that villain or scenario, the groundwork being laid for how that show is going to go for the next 20 to 25 episodes. And then you kind of visit that villain every sort of 3 or 4 episodes. And throughout that, you kind of have Dean and Sam having Monster of the Week. You know, we kill monsters. That's what we do. You know, and then they come back to the villain of the season in the last 3 or 4 episodes. It's all guns blazing. Somebody may or may not be killed off. Dean and Sam tend to die and then get brought back various times, or something fairly horrific happens to them, become a demon, become something else, whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how it was. So when season 14 finished, it finished with, and I don't agree with how the direction they went with this, but they set up God as the main villain of season 15. People can have whatever view they want here, but I'm not seeing it, because they'd set God up throughout the season, throughout the entire show as an ally. Mm-hmm. It didn't make sense to me to suddenly, and I think they said, you know, there's no bigger villain than God, and I was like, well, yeah, I don't really agree with their stance that they took on this. You know, I'm sure there's other villains that they could have had. However, they used that as a way of trying to wrap things up, actually. They used God as a tool to bring characters to an end throughout this run, throughout this season 15. And actually, episode 19 of this final season actually could have almost been the season finale, because they literally wrapped up everything. They wrapped up the entire show's worth of story within that episode. So I was, when episode 19 finished, I was like, oh, so what's going to happen next week? Mm-hmm. Right, because you've wrapped it all up. You've sort of, they didn't kill off God. They just sort of depowered God, or Chuck, if you want to call him that. And they made Jack the new God. Dean and Sam are alive. Castiel's dead. In fact, actually, by episode 19, everybody that they know is dead. Everybody that they brought back is dead, because there was a story a couple of years ago where they introduced a parallel world, which they used as a way of actually bringing back loads of people, like Bobby and Felicia Day's character and stuff like that. And that was actually quite a good tool. But by season 19, they literally got back. They got rid of everybody. So when, obviously, Jack says goodbye to them, and that's kind of the end, and they go off. So when episode 20 starts, I actually felt like sort of quite surreal when it started. So
yeah, like, because literally back to business as usual.
Well, so initially when it starts off in the bunker, and it's very quiet. The bunker's very quiet. There's just the two, and it's back to literally real back to basics. It's just the two
brothers being domestic.
Yeah, and so when I saw the emptiness, in a way, I felt was quite sad before even the show had got going, because in the last few years, the family that they'd built up with Jack, with Castiel, that they were gone. Like, you know, Bobby's now gone, and even all these ancillary characters that were floating around that could pop in and out of the bunker, everyone was gone. So literally everybody, I mean, obviously there's a few people out there like Garth and stuff that they know, mm-hmm. but it is now just really these two brothers. And that's what actually this last episode was purely about, was the relationship between these two brothers. Mm-hmm. And that's been the backbone of this show for the last 15 years, was their relationship. You know, it was Sam and Dean did everything for each other, and you know neither one of them could ever accept either of them dying, and would mm-hmm. make a deal with a crossroads demon, or you know, would sell their soul or whatever it was to save each other. So like you just said, it was very much you know, domestic life. Got up in the morning, social
media. They were
making
the bed, brushing the teeth, making breakfast, playing with the dog. I mean, it was very chill. And then it was kind of like they fall into their normal routine. It started out to me like any other random mid-season episode, where it's like they're doing the setup just to bring in the monster of the week. Then after they have their coffee, they're sitting at the table on the computer. They're looking for anomalies. They're looking for weird things. And when something pops up, you're kind of like, oh, here we go. We got a case. But no, it's not a case. It's a pie eating contest.
I did love that. That was really sweet. What's it? Sam goes to Dean, are you sure you really want to do this, before mm-hmm. they walk around the corner?
Yeah.
And Dean's like, yeah. You know, like, you know, whatever. And then suddenly the camera pans around, pie eating contest.
It's a pie fest.
And I was like, do you know what? Like, this is because this is the thing. This show did really use comedy well. And Dean was mainly, I would say, the comedy.
Oh, yeah. He's definitely much funnier than Jared.
Oh, yeah. Jensen Ackles, his comedy was great, like, throughout this whole 15 years. And then just to see his face, he's like, yeah, pie eating contest. And then I thought it was quite, actually quite sweet when Sam pushes his face in the pie.
Yes.
and he's like, I've been waiting ages to do that.
Yeah, I've been wanting to do that forever. Like, oh, man.
And then, like you just said, then it moves on to Case of the Week.
Right.
Which actually I thought was fairly horrific. Like, yeah. You know,
but it was interesting. Well, interesting. They used their agent names this week were Kripke and Singer, who Eric Kripke is a creator of the series, and Robert Singer is the executive producer of the series. So that was a nice ode.
Well, they've done it.
They've used those names before.
Oh, yeah. They've used odes before throughout the thing. There was an episode where they ended up playing themselves. I didn't ever see that or yes. not. And so there was, they ended up in a parallel world where they were Jensen Ackles and Jared as well.
That
and,
was season 6, French Connection. One of the best episodes called? Of the series, yes.
Like, yeah, they end up in like in the real world, and their real wives are in it as well. Like, mm-hmm. And then Castiel, they're like, your name is Misha. Like,
yeah, exactly.
but that's the thing about this whole 15 years. They've had some such great one-off episodes. But yeah, anyway, so they get the villain of the week is actually I was really taken back by how simple and basic it was. A group of vampires. Mm-hmm. Vampires
stealing kids.
Yeah, vampire serial killers. They had a bit of a thing about, you know, they were a bit of a you know, there was a bit different, you know, they wore masks and like you say, they went in and stole some kids and mm-hmm. killed people and stuff like that and had a nest and all that. And I thought it was quite good as well that the leader of the vampire group was a vampire that they'd met back in season 1 and hadn't seen them for 15 years. Yeah. I thought, actually, that's a good little callback. And actually did a little flashback to Jensen actually untying her. I thought that was quite nice. And so what happens next is they would never have allowed this in 15 years. Dean dies in this little rescue mission.
Which is the thing I'm not going to forgive about this episode, because I thought that that was just bullshit. And just throwing that out there, that really, really pissed me off, because I was like, of all the this is a routine mission. Like, of all of the times and millions of ways that you have killed these brothers off in 15 years, this is the way that you're actually going to kill Dean Winchester off permanently?
It's just, yeah, to fall into a sort of a little
stake
or something.
Yeah, it's to be impaled during a fight with a vampire?
Like in a barn or something. Here's the way he gets killed off is lame. Yes. However, and also the fact that their reaction to both of it was of complete acceptance.
Yes.
However, I really started to think about this, because I thought, okay, look, in 15 years, those two boys have, you know, like they said, this in one of the other previous episodes in this season was, you know, the sweat and the blood, that was all them. Mm-hmm. Like, they, in 15 years, let's be honest, they've not had a break. Like, you know, they've, yeah, well, they have literally been to hell and back, both of them.
Yes.
They have done so much for, like, the world that we, you know, if this was real, they, mm-hmm. they've done so much to protect.
Unsung heroes.
Yeah, unsung heroes. And, you know, and the way the episode started with the quietness and everything, and actually with Dean going to that pie-eating contest.
Yeah.
It felt to me like Dean was ready. Like, and that's why he accepted it. Because he was saying to his brother, like, you know, let me go.
Mm-hmm.
It felt to me like that whole episode was kind of setting up his death, was that he was done. Like, all his friends were gone. All his family was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And although him and Dean, Sam and Dean love each other, because of how quiet it was in the bunker, that these two boys had never really had a family, and then they kind of built a family around Castiel and Jack, and obviously they've had their mum alive for a couple of seasons, who unfortunately died again, but you know, and they'd built this relationship with Bobby and, well, the sort of Bobby from the other Earth and stuff like that. You know, there was a nice little family dynamic going on, and now it's just back to two boys again. And yeah, okay, those two boys love each other, but it felt like to me like we've defeated as many villains as we can now. Mm-hmm. And Dean just was like, no, I'm going, like, you know, say goodbye to me sort of thing. Which was extremely sad. I remember, like, really, when I was watching it earlier, I was like a bit caught in my throat. I was like, oh. Yeah.
No, and, I definitely teared up. But I, like, when they were just talking to each other, and especially when Dean was like, I need you to tell me that it's okay.
Yeah.
I definitely, definitely teared up at that part. But it's just, I wish they had worked harder to get to that point. Like, it could have been like, maybe he got bit by the vampire before Sam killed it. And it's, you know, like a more dramatic sort of death.
Yeah,
versus,
like, had no choice.
Like, the guy pushed you and now you're impaled. I mean,
yeah, actually, do you know, that would have been quite cool. Like, say if he had been bitten by the vampire and then Sam's got to take his head off, otherwise he's going to become a vampire.
Right, like, so that's what I thought was going to happen when they were fighting the vampires. But then there was a moment before, like, when in the middle of the fight, where the camera pans over to that post and you can see that piece of rebar sticking out. And I was like, don't tell me that this is how they're going to kill one of them off. And sure enough, I'm not upset that either of them died. Like, I don't think that they could have ended the series any other way. I think I've always thought that when they end Supernatural, both brothers are going to have to die, period. You can't leave any kind of room for guessing. They're going to have to give you a definitive ending. But it makes sense that Dean was the first to go, because Dean was the one who actually tried to live a life when he thought Sam was dead at the end of season 5, when we got soulless Sam in season 6. And he tried it. Like, Dean has already tried to live the domestic life and it didn't work for him. So the fact that they killed him off while he was still young, while he still had, like, all of his faculties about him, you know, like, I think in the end, it's good that he was the first to go. However, I'm still upset that he died in a routine fight. I'm just not going to let that part go.
They could have found a better way to kill him off. Do you know, the episode I felt was fairly flawless, other than that little one point where the way they kill him is fairly lame. You know, 15 years of fighting ghosts and vampires and werewolves and
you get taken out by some no-name vampire whose face we don't even get to see. I mean, honestly, that was garbage. That was the worst part of the episode. And I was sitting here and I was just like, rolling my eyes into oblivion, and I was like, really, this is okay. And then, like, the rest of the episode, sure, it's sentimental, and it's which I think that they do, on it, I think that they deserve a happy ending. If we're being honest, I'm glad that this is as happy of an ending as they probably could have given the Winchester brothers. But, like, the back half of the episode was just boring. It was like, oh, look, Sam got a call, so he's got to go back to the real... Oh, look, Sam got married, and he had a kid. Oh, look, Sam is helping the kid with the homework, and it's just kind of like...
I thought it was nice, though. Like, I know it was quiet and not exciting, but they've had 15 years of craziness, so it was like... when the next day, like, Sam wakes up in the bunker all on his own, I was like... This is truly it. Literally, everyone has gone now. Sam is truly just literally on his own. And when he gets that call and you see him walking around the bunker, even though he's going to that call, you know he's not coming back to that bunker.
Yeah.
He's going off to deal with that call and then he's done. Like, it felt to me like this was his last potential mission. Uh-huh. Although I don't think it was his last mission, because
his kid had the tattoo.
So I imagine that he did carry on to a degree, but maybe it was more, I don't know, like, maybe he trained his son up and his son's a hunter. The one thing I was really disappointed about was that he didn't have two sons. I thought, to me, that would have been perfect to have ended it with essentially two brothers, like, being able, two other Winchesters. I was like, oh, they really missed a trick there, like, you know, only having one Winchester brother. Although, you know, you don't know, but maybe Dean's got a kid out there that we don't know about. I mean, Dean did mess around a fair amount in 15 years. But what was quite nice, though, was you see Dean get to heaven and see Bobby, and, you know, Bobby says, you know, heaven's different now. All the walls are down. We're not living our greatest hits. It's all one shared heaven now. And then you see the Impaler, and Dean's face lights up and goes for a drive. And I know, obviously, it's sort of a bit dull and stuff, but I did quite like how at the same time as him going for his drive, obviously time moves differently in heaven.
Right.
So that's sort of...
I actually did like that part. So that time connection...
Yeah.
And like the both of those things were happening simultaneously. Like Sam is living out the rest of his life, but really Dean is just kind of like joyriding.
So he's doing like a 2 or 3 hour drive, and I don't know, for every hour 10 years of Sam's life goes past or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so you see, like you say, Sam gradually getting older, and having, I was a little bit annoyed by this, was you don't ever meet the wife. Like, yeah. who's the wife? They did this in bloody True Blood when they ended True Blood with Sookie got married or had a husband or boyfriend or whatever, and you never see him. In the final episode, you see her on a, you know, all her family around a big table, all her friends.
That was a series that did not deserve a happy ending, but that's a whole other conversation.
Well, they end it with seeing her with another man around the table, yeah. And you're like, well, who's that bloke? And yeah. It was exactly the same with Sam with the wife. You just see the wife in the background. And like,
yeah, blurry in the background.
Well, who is this woman? Like, I would like to have known who that was. I mean, I know you couldn't have given her much time to flesh out the character, but I did think, you know, could it have been someone we've already met? You know, they've met a lot of women in the last 15 years, even if they'd have brought back a guest star or something. I don't know, another little nod to the past was a missed opportunity.
Well, they killed off the perfect woman for Sam, but, you know.
Well, killed off many people. They could have brought her back. But anyway, so then, yeah, obviously, you know, you see the little training as well, which I thought was good, and the time with his son, mm-hmm. The homework and things like that, the impaler's still there. And then I thought it was quite nice that when he does end, you see his son has tattoos on his arm, like the same as Sam, showing that he's clearly a hunter as well.
The anti-possession tattoo.
You know, you always need an anti-possession tattoo. And then it was just like, it was really cool to see Dean pull over looking out of the water, and he just goes, "Hello, Sammy," and turns around. Yeah. And then his brother's there, and they hug each other, and they're both the same age again.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, like, you know, that's
yeah. By that point now, I was definitely bawling, because it was just Dean saying the "Hey, Sammy." I was just like, oh my gosh, that part was really sweet. That part was definitely really sweet.
And then when the titles come up, then suddenly the titles stop again, and you see the actual actors turning around and saying thanks to all the fans.
Yeah.
And then it pans out, and you see the bridge full of
the whole crew.
No social distancing, by the way, going on there. Like, this is clearly pre COVID. And
no, so it wasn't. They remember they had not? 6 episodes left to film when COVID shut them down.
I thought these were done before. Maybe I'm wrong.
It was the last 6 episodes of the season that were put on hold, which is why it took so long to finish the season. It was supposed to finish way earlier.
I thought they'd started them or something, but anyway. But maybe they're in a bubble then. A huge bubble with a lot of people in it. But what I thought was quite nice, it pans out and you see like 50 people on this bridge, like sound people and camera people and all that. I just sort of, when this finished, I was like really sort of sat back and sort of reflected a little bit, like thinking the season itself, I'm never going to agree with the villain being God. I'm just never get on board with that. Like, but I did like the fact that this season did replay a lot of their greatest hits as well. Mm. Like, and it did touch on some nice moments. There was, you know, they went to purgatory, although we didn't meet Benny, but there was a flat, but Benny was in a dream sequence at one in the episode. You saw Garth. They used a lot of classic villains like ghosts, vampires, werewolves. You know, we got to see Eileen again. Michael came back, you know, as their half brother. They resolved the dangling plot of Kaya, who is a character from another Earth and stuff like that.
Whatever happened with Adam?
I can't remember now. Like, there's a lot of people. And then Jody was in it as well. Not throughout the season as well. There was a lot in there. They kind of brought the Men of Letters to a sort of an end as well this mm-hmm. season. They sort of, do you know, actually, that was one of the things I loved when they introduced the bunker several seasons ago for the Men of Letters. I really loved that bunker. I thought it was really cool that they had a bunker that also had its own mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was really quite cool that they finally had a base.
Yeah, me too.
So I, because I before that
I was sick of them being in motels.
Like, and I mean, occasionally we're in motels here and there after that, but it was a lot of it was then working out of the Men and Letters thing. I thought that was quite cool. I liked it when they, was it a couple of seasons ago, they rescued Mary and Jack from like Earth 2 and brought across like Bobby and a bunch of other hunters at the beginning of the previous season. And loads of hunters and Bobby and stuff were living out of the bunker. And suddenly the bunker had like, life. They didn't do it for long, like two or three episodes, but they had like 10, 15, 20 people living in this bunker. And I was like, that's what they should do like all the time. Like have various hunters living in this bunker, like coming and going.
It should be like like a bed and breakfast sort of, where like you come, you stay for a little while, and then you can move on to something else.
You can, it could almost be like a Stargate type base. You know, you see like hunters A and B going off and B and C come back in and, you know, like, I don't know, that was a thing that they didn't use enough. But I did love it that every now and again, probably every season, they had one or two episodes that had a mystery in the bunker that tied into like the previous Men of Letters. The Men of Letters is probably one of my favorite things that they introduced. It obviously wasn't part of the original plan.
I just wish they had done more with it. I feel like there was so much potential with the Men of Letters, and then especially when they brought in like the international Men of Letters, there was so much more they could have done with that, and it just kind of nothing happened.
I kind of wondered what, like, throughout the last 15 years, did you have a favorite episode?
Absolutely. My favorite episode of Supernatural has not changed from the moment I watched it. My favorite episode is season 2, the season premiere. It's called In My Time of Dying.
Oh, where Jeffrey Dean Morgan dies.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is a phenomenal episode. I'm pretty sure with that episode, I cried from beginning to end. Like, it was just so emotional.
So that wasn't the plan. He was meant to be a series regular. They wanted him to stay on for the whole of the season, but Jeffrey Dean Morgan's a popular man. So they obviously had to kill him off. But yeah, that was, yeah, that took me back, because he would guest starred in season 1, and then he was in the last few episodes of season 1.
Right.
And then when he was in season 2 premiere, I was like, oh, you know, like, even I thought, yeah, they're going to have him really in it. And then they killed him off. I was like, oh, crap.
My favorite episode of all time has always been In My Time of Dying.
I've got a couple of favorite episodes. Like, I loved the Scooby-Doo crossover. Have you seen it?
I need to watch that one though.
Like, that is really good. Like, seeing Sam and Dean walk into the, like, the bar or whatever, and walk up to the Scooby gang and you know, can we sit, you know, like, and yeah, like, it's brilliant. My other favorite episode has got to be the 300th episode, where John Winchester comes back. And they have, it's like a Last Supper. They have like, you know, a Last Supper. That actually is really nice. So they bring back Jeffrey Dean Morgan. They suck him out of time from like 2003. So it's after Mary's died, but it's obviously before his own death. So that was really nice, like just putting the four of them together. But unfortunately, they have to accept that he has to go back, because he has been pulled out of time. So time is starting to change. So he has to go back. And when he goes back, he forgets. But obviously, they don't. Did you have a favorite character outside of Dean and Sam?
Yes, Crowley. I loved Crowley. I love Crowley because you were never sure if he was good or bad, but you could always be sure that Crowley was going to put Crowley first.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, 100%.
I loved him. He was fantastic.
You know, as an actor, like... I've seen him in The Odd Thing, but in Supernatural, he was standout. Like, and in the hour episode they had before, they talked about how he spoke. And they said they'd love to have
William Shatner.
Like William Shatner. Like, they said if there was a scene with William Shatner and Crowley together, that would be brilliant. But you know, like you say, he was really good. Just the way he spoke and everything, and the way he came across, you just didn't know. You know, because occasionally he did do things that were good, and then other times he did things that were just outright terrible, and you never knew what day it was with him.
Exactly.
But however, most episodes would end with he would get the upper hand and disappear or whatever. But like a lot of their villains become their friends. He did grow a fondness for mainly Dean. And it did turn into a little bit of a bromance between the two of them.
Yeah. It almost kind of not, I mean, it's not as contentious, but it almost kind of reminds you of like Batman and the Joker. Like, it's almost like you can't have one without the other. Like, what would Crowley be without the Winchesters, and where would the Winchesters be without Crowley?
Yeah, it's a shame that it got rid of him, but yeah. I did love the replacement for Crowley, which was Rowena.
His mom. Yeah, she's great.
She was. I wasn't really so keen on her in the beginning, but then I did love it as time went on, that seeing the bond between Rowena and Crowley as well.
Yeah.
And then when Crowley went, I thought that they would also get rid of Rowena or phase her out. I was a bit shocked that they kept her around. Mm-hmm. But then actually, once she was on her own, she could really stand out as her own character. But she was different. So Crowley really bonded with Dean. But Rowena seemed to have a real love for Sam.
Mm-hmm.
And you could tell in the end that she really started to, you could see that she loved them both. Mm-hmm. But she was, I wouldn't say as devious as Crowley.
Not at all.
She took on sort of this motherish type role for them both.
Yeah.
It's honestly 15 years of Supernatural coming to an end. And
yeah.
I think it was a nice episode. I think if they'd have tried to, inside in episode 19, if they'd have tried to wrap everything up,
it would have been too much
and kill Sam and Dean off or do whatever their ending was.
Yeah.
I think it would have probably been a terrible season finale or series finale. I actually think this approach they took,
it was perfect. Because this episode, like I said, I have not watched Supernatural since season 8 when I had my little tantrum. So the fact that I could watch this episode and I did not feel like I was missing anything. I did not have to ask, like, who the hell is this character, or who are they talking about, or why is this guy here? I didn't have those kinds of questions because this episode literally stripped everything else away and went back to basics.
Yeah, and that's what the show has been about. It's been about two brothers.
It was perfect. Other than the stupid way that Dean died, I'm not going to forgive you for that. But other than that, this episode was a perfect way to end a series that started with two brothers and ended with two brothers.
And I liked the ending, and I reflected on this ending as well, thinking how could this have gone differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought the other approach I thought they were going to take was it was just a monster of the week case, and then they kind of get back to the bunker, and again it sort of ends with them getting another call and jumping in the car.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like because to Sam and Dean it was the ongoing battle. They were never gonna, as long as they had each other, they were never going to stop killing monsters.
Mm-hmm.
And that was going to be their life until they died. So that's kind of what I thought was the approach that they were going to take. However, this approach, I think, was a much better way because it actually gave this show an ending.
Yes.
And I think throughout the last year or two, the people at the CW have been saying that they didn't want this show to end. It was Jared and Jensen that wanted this to end.
Right.
And however, they said, you know, if you ever want this to come back, just ask Jared and Jensen.
Yeah.
So I'm imagining that the two actors probably said,
we have to have a definitive end. Period.
And I think that they did well to do that because...
Yeah.
Although you're never going to stop people going, oh, will there be a Supernatural reboot or whatever? Right. People are always going to ask those questions. But I think the answer is like, well, no. We're in heaven.
This series was, I would say that more so than the storylines themselves, but the fan base for this series is too rabid. You could not have left an open-ended. I think the ending that you described, them kind of riding off after the next phone call into the sunset, that would have been perfect. And it would have been very on brand for Supernatural and for Sam and Dean. But I think these fans are too extreme. So the fact that the only other option is if we can't leave it open-ended, we got to kill them. And we can't, it can't just be like, oh, well, there was an explosion, but we never saw the body. No, like they're dead. They have died. They are gone. This is the end. So I do like that it was very definitive.
I think it's good that it was nice and tied up and that actually we're not wondering. And the only way I can see a Supernatural reboot happening, and I'm sure at some point there will be, CW likes to, they pull Charmed off the, off the thingy.
Yeah,
and,
give it 10 years.
Yeah, there'll be Supernatural again. But however, Sam has had a kid and it could follow the kid. You know, yeah. Like, they probably won't use the same actor if they do it in 10 years because he'll be a lot older. So, but it could be that they use Sam's kid, and that might actually fall, well, maybe 10, 15 years. You know, Sam's died. You know, they'd have to be a bit of a time jump. Mm-hmm. But because they've also wiped the deck clean in terms of all of their characters from the whole show pretty much were killed off, other than like Jody and a couple of the girls with Jody Mills, they've pretty much all been killed off. Those are the only people they could potentially come back, the Wayward sisters, as they were potentially going to be. Do you know what though? I would more than happily have the Wayward sisters back. Like, I loved all those characters.
Okay, if you had to pick a favorite villain out of 15 years of villains, who would be your favorite villain?
I don't know, like, Crowley was a good villain, but he did become more like a frenemy than a villain. I liked Lucifer in the beginning, but he got overdone. I liked Mara, actually, the Darkness. She was pretty good. I think I'm struggling to come up with a favorite villain, actually. Do you know what, actually? I liked quite... what I liked was actually the basic, when they introduced the sort of the men in letters from England and kind of made them sort of the villain of that season. Mm-hmm. I know it was quite basic, but actually I did quite like the approach that they took, that it was more of a down-to-earth style thing. Mm-hmm. I'm actually struggling to come up with a favorite villain just because I there was a lot that I enjoyed throughout the show. It's difficult as well because the villains were played, most of them were played quite loose in terms of they could side of you and not side of you. Mm-hmm. I do think Lucifer was really overdone. I think again because the actor they loved, so they brought him in and out. I don't know, I could tell you more. I prefer my favorite probably side hero character was probably Jody Mills. I loved her.
Okay.
I think
mine might be Rufus.
Do you know what? I loved Garth as well.
Yeah.
But Jody Mills is probably my favorite side hero person.
Yeah. I love Jody.
She's really good. I'm struggling to come up with a favorite villain. They've had good villains over the years, but I don't know if any of them really jumps out as a favorite.
I mean, I liked Lucifer because Mark Pellegrino I thought was really good. My second favorite villain would be Lilith.
Well, Lilith obviously was played by multiple actresses across the thing. They had Lilith show up again in season 15 for a couple of episodes. And so that's like season 15 has definitely been like their greatest hits. Mm-hmm. So anyway... We should probably stop talking about Supernatural. We've talked about it quite a while. We obviously clearly enjoyed the finale. And although you haven't watched every episode, I have watched all 15. And it was a slog to get through some of them. But I'm glad I did it. I can't believe I started watching this in 2005. But I think it was a nice episode to end this season. End this whole show. And like you say, that you didn't need to watch the last couple of episodes. So if you were originally a fan and tuned out, you could definitely come back to finish the story off.
Yeah.
This episode could have been put after season eight or nine, and you wouldn't necessarily have to have known anything in between. We rated this 4.5 out of 5.
Yeah.
We thought it was a really strong final episode.
We enjoyed it. I mean, it's hard to wrap up 15 years, but I think the ending that they chose is the best given the circumstances. So finally, the Winchesters finally got a happy ending. Good God, it took 15 seasons, but they finally got a happy ending.
I'm pleased for them both.
Yeah.
So recommendations. I watched the pilot episode of a new drama crime show, probably the best way of describing it, called Big Sky. It's kind of, I feel like it's got the potential to go either way. I think you could watch a couple more episodes. I think this, it could be like one of these shows where they have one season and then just disappears. Mm-hmm. It could go either way, like I say, but I watched the whole first episode. first 20 minutes is a bit like how we described Sea of Sorrows earlier. They were obviously introducing a lot of characters and the whole location and everything like that. There was a lot going on, you know, going here and there, and introducing the main character of Ryan Philippe, and the two sort of, well, there's a whole bunch of other characters, but there's two ladies that he works with in his private detective agency, and they've got a secretary, and I can't remember any of their names, to be honest. And but because they did put a lot around his character Cody, and then they show this serial killer who, well, I think he's a serial killer because they mention about prostitutes that have gone missing for the last several years in this one area, but they've never been able to work out who it was. So you get introduced to a truck driver who kidnaps a prostitute, and then on his drive he has a disagreement on the road with these two girls, and ends up kidnapping them because their car breaks down, and then Ryan Philippe's character goes looking for them. Now look, obviously spoiler warning, if you really it ends with a big old twist, which I, you know, it was a good twist, it was well played out. So like I say, Ryan Philippe has been billed as the main character, he's in the middle of all the posters or anything like that, so he teams up with this highway highway patrolman, and he ends up, like, they end up meeting up to go looking for these girls. They get into his car, he's going to drive, etc., because he's got like a lead on something of where these two girls might be. Gets into the car, and honestly about 30 seconds to a minute before what happens, I thought to myself, do you know what, he's in on it, this highway patrolman. However, I did not think what would happen at this end would happen. He turns around and he shoots Ryan Philippe's character right in the head.
Man.
And that's it. Blood all over the counter, over the dashboard, the window, you name it. And they've actually killed off the main character within the first episode. I was like, no way. That was a good twist. I hats off to them for doing that. Literally getting a big name like Ryan Philippe and then killing him off in the first episode. Well done. I like Ryan Philippe. I've got no issues with Ryan Philippe. You know, I've not watched much of his stuff. I Know What You Did Last Summer, but that's probably about it. But I thought, what a good twist.
He was on TV for a while, though, because I think he was in the TV version of Shooter.
Yeah. I've not seen it, though. Well, I know he was the main star of Shooter. But, I was like, oh, that's, like, really well done. I thought, you know, to actually get somebody and build them as the main character and then kill them off. It's a trick that's been used quite a few times in films. Mm-hmm. Samuel Jackson in Deep Blue Sea.
I will never forget that cameo, ever.
They've done it loads of times, but I think they've done it mainly in movies. I can't think of another example in TV. But yeah, that's my recommendation this week. Big Sky. I've ruined the twist for you now. But if you want to watch it knowing the twist, I'm definitely prepared to give this a couple more episodes.
My recommendation this week is actually a comic and not an anime. So look at me. My recommendation this week is Marvel Voices, Indigenous Voices, number one. And I picked up the variant cover that has, I want to say her name is Moonstruck, Dani Moonstruck on it.
Moonstar. Yeah.
Dani Moonstar. It is a gorgeous variant cover. It's drawn by Jeffrey Varegi. I don't know that I'm pronouncing that right. If I'm not, I apologize. But this book is really cool. It's got three separate stories in it. But it sort of opens up with Jeffrey Varegi, who is a Native American artist and writer. Kind of giving you like a little rundown of every Native American Marvel character. So that part is really interesting. And the artists and writers that they put in this book, they're all, obviously, they're Native American. This month is, November is National Native American Heritage Month here in the US. And so Marvel released this book just in time. I think what I love most about this book is the way that the characters are drawn really captures features that let you know that these characters are Native American, as opposed to generic characters that are colored in the right way to make you think that they are of a different ethnicity.
So that's what kind of struck me the most, like within each of these stories, is as I'm reading, just looking at the art and getting to see the features and the diversity on the pages. The second story, which is the story of Danny, is probably my favorite of the three. But they focus on different eras, different characters. It's really interesting. It's sort of like a step into this realm of all of these different characters. It's not the first time that Marvel has done something like this. They also did something like this during Black History Month when they had Black voices. So I would definitely recommend picking this up. There are several different variant covers you can get, but the book, the artwork is gorgeous. The introduction to all of these characters is also gorgeous. And it's just, it's a really interesting look at some characters that I know for sure, half of them I had never even heard of. So it's an interesting look into this kind of different realm of superheroes. So pick that up, Marvel Voices, Indigenous Voices. And as a reminder, we do have a second podcast. It is where we tackle some of the best graphic novels of all time. Our second Late to the Party graphic novel that we read was Alan Moore's V for Vendetta, which came out at the beginning of November. Our next book is going to be Scott Pilgrim's Precious Little Life, which is volume one of the Scott Pilgrim series. We're going to be releasing that first week of December. So you still got time to pick up Scott Pilgrim, read it along with us. I actually just finished it today. It is a super short, super fun read. It is not nearly as heavy as the first two books that we read, which the first one was Mouse and the, again, V for Vendetta is the second one. So follow along with us with that.
Thank you very much. And you can follow us on social media. We are Geeks Unleashed on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.
And you can get this podcast wherever you get your podcasts, Podbean, Google, Apple, Spotify, anywhere. And be sure to give us one of those coveted 5-star ratings and leave us a review.
And we're on Podchaser as well. We just sorted that out the other day. Find us
on Podchaser. We are all over the internet.
Yeah, everywhere. Anyway, have a good week. Thank you very much for listening.
Bye. Now your life's no longer empty. Surely heaven waits for you.